White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 371. And welcome to Open Wheel, the White Rocket Formula One and IndyCar podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined by my regular co-host for this program, the great racing master, Alan J. Porter. Welcome back aboard, Alan.
Thank you. It's been a long time since we talked racing, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's true. Well, we've started our James Bond monthly sessions. And for those that don't know, because that's in a different podcast feed, if you want to hear Alan and me together talking about James Bond, one movie per month in order, then check out On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. It's on same venues you find this. But we've, because of that and because of my other commitments the last few months, haven't been able to stay current. We did a show back around the beginning of the season. So we figured we definitely, if nothing else, have to come back at the end and just do kind of a season wrap-up for Formula One and for IndyCar. So before we dig into it, Alan, what are your thoughts here at the end of these two seasons of racing this year?
Both very interesting seasons for very different reasons, I think. I think we'll get into it in a bit more, but Formula One overall was an excellent championship fight. Certainly the first half of the year, the lead was changing backwards and forwards. Looked like it was going to be a real tight fight between Hamilton and Vettel. And then second half of the season, after the summer break, it was like complete Hamilton hair. I'm going to have fun if I can't say his name, aren't I? It was complete Hamilton dominance for the second half of the season. It's just like he completely broke both Vettel and Ferrari mentally. It was very interesting. And, you know, some good stuff going on. Good midfield battles. IndyCar was interesting for the other reason, because we had the new cars, which were, for me, as the sort of racing cars I love to see, where basically they've got more power than grip, less downforce. And it was interesting to see the way that the drivers were adapting to that, and some of the way the racing sort of changed, that the ovals became sort of boring and the road course races became really exciting. So, two very different seasons, very different reasons, but both, I think, really good seasons this year for both F1 and IndyCar.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed both seasons this year. I think I enjoyed IndyCar more for most of the season because it was so competitive. And I'd also add that I agree with you that Hamilton kind of put Vettel away and rode away with it at the end, but I think the most impressive driver in pretty much the second half of the season, certainly like the last third of the season, was Max Verstappen.
Yeah, even though Max always said that he hadn't changed his driving after being an idiot at Monaco, I think everybody agrees he did, and that little extra level of maturity certainly started to show in the last half dozen races of the season. And I think we'll get to it later, but unless Red Bull have made a huge mistake with the engines for next year, I think he's going to be a contender for, if not next year, certainly the year after.
So. I know, I hate, that's the thing, is just when you feel like you got it going, you hate to see anything change. And I wish they could just keep going the way they're going now for like one more year, because I feel like where they left off, Max was the second best driver in Formula One, even though I don't think he had the second best car. I think he had pretty much established himself over Ricciardo in the second half of the season, not the first, and I think he'd established himself over Bottas in the second half of the season. And I think that really only Lewis Hamilton and on his day maybe Vettel was really his superior much of the time.
Yeah, I'd agree that Hamilton and Verstappen were definitely the top two on the grid by the end of the season, very much so. It's great to see Max maturing, and some of his drives were really good towards the end of the year.
Maturing with one notable exception that we'll get to in a little bit. One notable exception.
I didn't say it was totally mature.
Right.
I said it was maturing.
Right. Well, all right. What we're going to do, we'll do about a half an hour on Formula One, and we'll do about a half an hour IndyCar, plus or minus, whatever it takes, and kind of dig down deep a little bit. So if you're not interested in Formula One, you're only interested in IndyCar, you might want to skip ahead about a half an hour here. It may take less than that. It may take more than that, but we'll see. But the season overall, yeah, we did have an interesting lead change, and it did look like, but you know, this is the same sort of thing that happened last year, is that it looked like Vettel was as good or better than anybody else at the beginning of the season. And then just like last year, it lasted a little longer this year. I think that's why it was a little more competitive this year. It seemed a little more competitive. It lasted a little bit longer than it last year. But in both cases, after you got to about the third of the way in, Ferrari started to fade. And I honestly never had confidence that they could hang in there the way it would be necessary. Did you really think that Vettel and maybe Raikkonen and Ferrari would be the top team or could be the co-top team and really challenge the whole season? Or did you kind of see it the way I did?
I would say pretty much, maybe for a little longer. I think it was sort of pretty much up until the summer break, which is probably about two-thirds of the way through the season. I thought they stood a chance of being competitive, but they started strong. Vettel won the first two races out of the box in Austria and Bahrain, and it looked like it was going to be a strong race. And then, you know, he was sort of racking up a few more wins. I'm just actually looking to see when was the last time he won. Sort of Belgium, I think Spa was the last one he won. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was 13 races in out of the 21. And then he really seemed to lose his way after that. And particularly the Italian Grand Prix the weekend after, it looked like that could have been a Ferrari 1-2 when Ferrari just sort of seemed to throw it away. And it just sort of spiraled down from there on onwards, I think. And it was interesting. It wasn't just that sort of Vettel was beaten mentally. I think it was Ferrari as well. They started to make some very dubious tactical calls, and also Vettel was really starting to try and manage the team from the cockpit based on some of the radio stuff and questioning calls and asking why they were doing stuff. So, I think that the team was in a little bit of tactical disarray. There was times when they should have swapped the cars around and sort of told Kimi Raikkonen to let Vettel pass just to sort of gain one or two extra points, and they didn't do that. They never really clearly said, you know, you're going to support Vettel. And then of course I think it was the Italian Grand Prix where they basically told Kimi Raikkonen that he'd lost his job for next season and then go out and support Vettel, like he was not going to do that. So it was I think it was both a tactical mistakes by Ferrari and also Vettel just losing his way. And he has actually said since the season's finished that he was not driving to the best in the second half of the season, that he was not the driver he could be, which was interesting for him to come out and admit that after the season finished. So,
it seemed pretty obvious. I'm glad he was willing to say that, but I think that we all pretty much could see that he really dropped off mentally.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't having the hissy fits in the cockpit like he did in previous seasons, but,
Oh Lord. Yeah. I did miss that. That's true.
Yeah.
I want to get your opinion on this. Somebody has said that the thing about Vettel, and it's the thing that Verstappen sometimes exhibits too, and it's the thing I don't like about Verstappen, is that both of them have a propensity at times to act like, I'm so great that I can do whatever I want and act however I want and nobody can do anything about it.
Yeah, and I sort of get that from Verstappen. I mean, he is young and he's coming through, but, you know, Vettel's a 4-times world champion. He should know better.
Yeah.
He should be more mature. That's the one thing with Lewis Hamilton. He has, if you look,
yes,
he used to be like that. You know, I mean, he almost won the world championship in his rookie season, you know, and won multiple world championships since. But he's over the years, he's matured and matured and matured. And I think this year was actually the most mature, complete driver we've seen Hamilton be. And in doing that, I think he completely overwhelmed the rest of the guys on the grid. And some of that, I think, is his increasing maturity. And it is actually scary to me because I still think of him as the young gun who came on. You know, he's only been there a few years, but he's actually now the second oldest driver.
Wow.
On the grid. And if Kimi Raikkonen had actually retired, he would have been the oldest driver on the grid. So, yeah, he's been around quite a few years.
But he doesn't seem like it, though. You know, that's the thing. He seems young and spry and healthy. He's not like Raikkonen, who just seems like an old crusty veteran just waiting to retire. That's the way Raikkonen comes across. I bet Raikkonen came across that way when he was 20, though. But, yeah, no, Lewis comes across like he's 19.
In a good way. Yeah, and he's got that enthusiasm and desire to race and win, and it comes over very strongly. I think, you know, to your point, with Vettel and Verstappen, it sometimes becomes that, you know, I've got to get this corner at all costs. That was interesting after the event. I'm sure we'll come to the Verstappen-Ocon event that Lewis said to Verstappen in the green room afterwards. He was like, he didn't have anything to lose. You did. You know, you should have thought about that before you go wheel to wheel. So, you know, Lewis has got that overall racecraft, big picture thinking, as opposed to, you know, Vettel and Verstappen. Sometimes we make some good, interesting racing, but sometimes they're like, I've got to get this corner at all costs. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I want to talk about the three top teams, and we've done a little bit already, but speaking of Lewis in that way, I'm going to put a theorem to you, and you tell me what you think about it. I'm going to suggest to you that Lewis had, in one of the reasons Lewis had such a great season this year, and I think we can agree that a lot of it was Lewis mentally. It wasn't just his car was superior to everybody else's car. You know, it was that he was by far most of the season the superior driver out there. And I will put it to you, and a lot of that is mental, obviously. I will put it to you that he does better when he has a partner who is deferential. Okay, when he has a partner that's competitive, he gets all wrought up and it gets in his head and he gets really psyched about it. Whereas when he has a partner that's a teammate that's more deferential to him, then he kind of seems like he can relax and be very loosey-goosey and grinning, and then he can really go for it. He just seems like a different person when he's not having to compete with his own teammate. What do you think about that?
I actually think I disagree with that, because this is the first time he's really had a partner that's been deferential. I mean, you know, his previous teammates were, you know, Fernando Alonso and Jenson Button at McLaren. So he was, you know, against other world champions. Mm-hmm. And then Nico Rosberg at Mercedes. Mm-hmm. So Bottas is really the first one he's come across who's been to some degree deferential, and I think that's actually more the fact that Bottas had a terrible season this season. I think he lost it mentally, like Vettel. I think Lewis was there mentally because he was prepared and he was doing sort of some. Mercedes let him have a lot more leeway this year in what he did off track, and it sort of seemed to energize him doing the, you know, the fashion lines and the charity stuff, and you know, him you know. I've sort of heard several people say that because he was doing that, he was actually turning up at the race weekend more energized and fresh and ready to get in. And his work ethic on the race weekend was like stellar. But he wasn't burnt out from doing all sorts of stuff, race stuff in between. He was completely 110% focused on the race weekend. But in between, he was getting that sort of downtime and mental refresh. So I sort of tend to disagree with you there. I think Bottas is a good, respectable, probably very good Grand Prix driver. But unfortunately, I think this season he found himself up against somebody who was verging on being up with the all-time greats and was exceptional, because his car, the Mercedes, was not the best car on the grid. And Hamilton was making it do things that he shouldn't do. I mean, a few times in qualifying, he like completely destroyed Bottas. At Singapore, when he just pulled out he and Verstappen pulled out qualifying laps that were just spectacular. I think he just sort of, and Bottas just sort of mentally lost it, particularly after he lost, a couple of races through bad luck, like the blowout he had at Baku when he was in the lead, and then in Russia being told to move over and make way for Lewis. you know, I think that just mentally destroyed Bottas. And I did yes. sort of read that basically the Mercedes bosses told him to go away over the winter and clear his mind and come back with a fresh attitude. So yeah, I think Bottas was just put out to pasture a bit by both Lewis and his own mental weakness. That's easy for me to say because, of course, I couldn't do any of that stuff. But
That's what we're here to do. That's what we're here to do is act like we know better than they do. So that's
But it is interesting that Bottas this year is the first time that there was a Mercedes driver who didn't win even a single race. I mean, don't forget, Bottas won 3 races last year. He's no slouch. He got a few pole positions, so he's a really good driver.
That's what I want to ask you: is how good is he really? I mean, I know he did better last year than he did this year, but considering that Lewis was so dominant the second half of the season, I mean, what that really did was just show it highlighted, fairly or unfairly, it highlighted Bottas's shortcomings. When you're both supposedly in the same car and one person is doing so great in it and the other's doing so terrible. I mean, if any other team, I think they would have fired Bottas if they hadn't won the world championship. No,
he's very quick. He is a natural. When he was in the Williams, he basically made the Williams go quicker than it could. So he's a quick driver. Certain tracks, the smoother the surface, like Russia, he can be dominant. So he's got the skills. I don't think what he's got is that mental toughness and racecraft to take the most of the opportunities. He doesn't appear to have some of that determination. Like when he was catching Vettel or Vettel was catching him and he made no attempt to really defend it. So I think he doesn't necessarily have that mental determination to make the best of the opportunities in front of him. And exceptional drivers like, Verstappen and Vettel and Alonso and Hamilton, I'll take a car and drive beyond the car's capability. I think Bottas can drive up to the car's capability and probably not much beyond it. So,
Well, how does he compare to Nico Rosberg in that position? I'm on record that I was a big Nico Rosberg fan. I get excited when he comes out and does the TV stuff. I'm like, hey, it's Nico. And he's just such a personable guy. I just love him. He's just such a nice, personable, friendly guy. And I love the fact that the first year I started watching Formula One was that great epic battle between him and Lewis. And he did it. He pulled it out. I cannot, Alan, under any circumstances, imagine Valtteri Bottas doing what Nico Rosberg did in 2016. Is that fair?
That's fair. I don't think he's got the mental strength to do what Nico did.
Okay. Nico look better, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I think Nico could have probably gone on and, maybe challenged Lewis last year. I don't think he could have challenged him this year, but I think he could have challenged him last year.
Yeah.
I must admit, with all the stuff with the other Mercedes driver, Ocon, because of all the moves, ending up without a drive, if I was in Toto Wolff's position as boss of Mercedes, I think I'd be sidelining Bottas as the reserve driver and putting Ocon in the second car.
Oh, yeah.
But it depends what they'd already decided before Ocon got lost in the shuffle. So I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to see Ocon in the car in 2020.
I hope so. I really hope so. I like Valtteri Bottas. He's a nice guy, but he doesn't do anything for getting you excited to watch a race.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so we talked about the Mercedes. We talked about Vettel a little bit. Anything else about Vettel? And what do you think about Kimi Raikkonen? He finally won a race after he decided to go to Sauber when Ferrari kicked him out. It was just a weird sequence of events for Kimi this year.
It was. I mean, I've always liked Kimi. He's a great character, despite the Iceman stuff. If you watch some of the more offbeat interviews, he's actually got a real wicked sense of humor. He's great on the radio. I really like him a lot. And I remember him being the amazing driver he was in the early part of his career, and then he went and did NASCAR, and then came back, and he sort of. Again, not had that killer spirit, but I was delighted to see him win at COTA. It was a great drive of the United States Grand Prix, and it was great to see him win. And as you said, that was sort of after he already knew he wasn't going to be a Ferrari driver next year. So he sort of hung on season by season. At the end of every season, it's like, oh, good grief, is he going to do another season? So I know they said it wasn't a seat swap with him and Leclerc, but it sort of looks that way.
Yeah.
With Leclerc going to Ferrari and him going back to Sauber, where he started his career, got 17, 18 years ago. So it'll be interesting to see. And he's on a two-year contract, which is unusual for Kimi because he normally does one-year one. So it'll be interesting to see what he's going to do at Sauber and whether, you know, I think I think they will certainly benefit from his years of experience. And hopefully that team will continue its upward rise with him there.
Well, let's look at it. I mean, Sauber, like 2 years ago or 3 years, I forget, it was either 16 or 17, Sauber was the worst team. They were, a year or two ago, what Williams was this year. They were just woeful. And this year, and we're going to talk about Leclerc in just a minute, they were great. I mean, they were right up there in the middle of it. And I was rubbing my eyes going, is that Sauber? Really? You know, so I was very impressed. So I'm looking forward to Kimi there. If I had told you at the beginning of the season that a Finland, that one race all year would be won by a driver from Finland, would you have thought it was Kimi?
I would have hoped it was, but
you would have thought it was Bottas. Come on, you know.
Yeah. No, I would have put money on Bottas, but I would have hoped it was Kimi. But I mean, thing is, Sauber, you know, back in the day, 10 years ago, were a race winning team with Robert Kubica when they had BMW finance and BMW engines and stuff. So you know, they have the capability, they have the experience. I think they just went through a whole, like Williams are now and McLaren to a less extent, going through a whole sorts of, you know, financial difficulties, then not being able to invest, which sort of dropped them further and further down the order. But you know, with the Ferrari Junior team status and the Alfa Romeo branding and obviously with all the stuff that came with that, it really helped them this year, and I think they're just going to rebuild. I can see them fighting for fourth in the championship next year comfortably if they continue on that line. So
that would be great. Yeah, I like them. I like them a lot, and I'm going to be liking them even more with Kimi, so that's cool. All right, so we hadn't talked about Red Bull really. We talked about Max some. Ricardo actually started out the year looking pretty darn good, and it was Max that was having reliability issues or crashes early on, and Ricardo actually won a couple of races. In fact, let's see, Ricardo actually won two of the first six races, which is amazing. Yep. And it looked like he was going to have quite a year. He had won as many races, you know, after six races, he had won as many races as Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel. That's amazing. But then after that, it kind of flipped over to Max. And so after that, eventually we find out that that Ricardo is going to go to Renault. So what are your thoughts on Daniel Ricardo, on Danny Ricci this year, and and him going to Renault and how things started so promising and kind of petered out on him there at the end?
Yeah, I don't know what it is with Red Bull. They always seem to have one driver that has a run of bad luck technically, and they sort of seem to swap. You know, it's very rare that they actually get both cars to the finish high up. They either have mechanical woes during the race or they have problems in practice and start at the back. I mean, both Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen both did great drives from the back at various points this year.
They did. But
you're right. At the beginning of the season, it seemed to be all the bad luck was going Verstappen's way, and then it flipped to Daniel Ricciardo. And then once he'd made the decision, and I know he said he was still committed to the team, but it was like he lost interest, really, for an extent. I mean, after one of the retirements, he sort of said, oh, there's no point in me turning up next Sunday because this is a farce. So that was not exactly,
And he said his car was cursed and he was ready to give it to somebody else.
Yeah, give it to the new guy because I'm done with it.
Yeah, you can't blame him. So, I mean, gosh.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think he got disillusioned with that. So the move to Renault is very interesting because he must know historically, somebody going from a race-winning team to a lower-order team that hasn't won a race, it does not historically work out particularly well for their careers. Fernando Alonso being a good example. So it's an interesting decision he's made. I think he sort of looks at him taking the leadership of that team and trying to build it back into a race-winning team. I think with Nico Hülkenberg as a teammate, he's going to have a harder job at that than he probably thinks he is. But I think he's obviously got that. He needs something new, I think. I think he's looking for a new challenge. And obviously, I think that's what helped spur the Renault thing But it is interesting considering the number of technical engine Renault engine failures they've had this year that affected him, that he's actually gone to that team. So
yeah,
I think that took everybody by surprise. And of course, the great thing it did was open up the driver market to the craziness of all the seat swaps we've now got for the next race, next year.
And so, boy, did it. So yeah. I got to tell you, Renault is not messing around now, because they've got Daniel Ricciardo and Nico Hülkenberg. And Nico Hülkenberg, I think, very quietly finished, won the F1.5 championship.
Yeah, he won the Class B championship. Yeah, the best of the rest. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's not a bad combination for Renault to have, the best of the rest and one of the top six.
Yeah, no, I think he will do, I think it's a really good combination. I think they'll drive each other on. Mm-hmm. And Renault are continuing to invest in the team, and they've actually just done a slight rebranding to realign it more with the actual parent motor company than it was before. Mm-hmm. I think, and they're sort of rebuilding the staff that they lost over the years. So I think they're definitely going to make a run at trying to get into, that top six or top three team tiers. Maybe if the Red Bull Honda thing doesn't work out, it could be Renault could be the ones poised to step into that space.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something Ricciardo knows that we don't.
I'd love to see it. I like Renault. I like to see them competitive. The more, it's just like with any car, the more teams competitive, the more drivers competitive, the better it is. In fact, one of the top guys for Formula One, one of the new Liberty Media guys is a top guy at Formula One, did say a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you heard this, he said going the way we've been going is not tenable for the sport. He said, we cannot continue on with just a couple of drivers having a chance to win every week. It needs to be more, wide open. That's something that the famous NFL original commissioner understood. He always was talking about parity, wanting to have more competition and have everybody have a good, fair chance. And IndyCar has that. It really does. Whatever else you can say good or bad about it, IndyCar is anybody's race every week, pretty much. But Formula One, I mean, he came out and said, we can't continue like this. We've got to do things to make it to where everybody has a fair chance. And I like that. I like that kind of talk. I mean, some people may not. I know the Ferrari people feel like it should be whoever throws the most money and, Italians at the problem should dominate. But I'm firmly on the ground of I'd love to have all the cars out there with a chance to win.
Yeah, I mean, that's been said on and off for years, decades even in Formula One. And if you look back through history, there's never really been a time when there's been complete parity.
Right.
There has been a time when, maybe four or five teams can, and occasionally you'd get, if there's a rain affected race, you'd get somebody from lower down the grid, take a surprise win. And those were always great to see. I think it needs to be more open than it is. And they are gradually bringing in more and more standard parts, like next year that, the front wing and back wing are more standard, and they're sort of looking to do that. And I think where the Liberty Media is going and the designs they're looking at for the sort of 2020, 2021 seasons, that I think will hopefully bring some of that along as well. Excuse me. The interesting thing is whenever they do a regulations reset like that, you never know who's going to find that secret little thing. Like back in 2009, when Braun, what was the Braun Grand Prix team, which became Mercedes, they were the only ones to figure out a loophole in the, in the new regulations, and went out and like dominated the first half of the season. And they were a tiny, underfunded, privately owned team. And it took the rest of them like half a season to catch up onto what they were doing. So, yeah, whenever there's a regulation change, there's always a chance that somebody in one of the lower teams is going to figure out something quickly and steal a march on everybody else, which is always fun to see when that happens.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking about those the middle teams, what did you think about them? I felt like Haas had a good year. I felt like Force India started bad, but did better later. Once they got their financial situation in order, they seemed to get better. We talked about Sauber having a really good year, which was exciting. And Renault was quietly good. There was never a week where I was like, oh, look at the Renaults going. And yet they just kind of plugged away and plugged away. In other words, I thought that, for example, I thought Sauber was more visually like, ooh, look at those guys. But then when you count all the points at the end, you're like, oh, well, Renault was there. Look at that.
So yeah, Renault finished fourth, didn't they, in the constructors?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Haas. There were some of the races where I pretty much ignored what was going on at the front because it was like I was going to be those, you know, somebody out of those six guys. Mm-hmm. And with Renault, Haas, Force India, Sauber, Toro Rosso, you know, I think they were, really, really playing really strongly in the midfield. And I think some of those midfield class B battles were, for want of a better phrase, was, the highlights of a lot of the races. There were some, there was a lot of races where I was sort of keeping track of who's going to be the last guy in the points. And, you know, what are the positions like 6 through 11 or 6 through 12 were really closely fought. And there was some really good battles there. Mm-hmm. So, as you said, Renault was sort of pretty steady. Not too many retirements and, got there in the end. And then we had Haas. Fifth in the championship. I know they were aiming for fourth, but they weren't better than last year. And this is still their, their third season in F1, and they're already fifth in the Constructors' Championship. It's great. Good consistency. Keeping the same drivers for next year as well. So hopefully we'll see more of that. It's still privately funded up until this year. No major sponsors. So an amazing achievement, I think, to work their way from new entry to fifth in just 3 years, I think is spectacular. And as you said, Sauber, I think a lot of that was down to Leclerc and the new injection of money. Toro Rosso were a bit all over the place. Sometimes Gasly, Sean Hartley had a terrible year. Yeah. Not always his fault. Force India, as you mentioned, we had the two Force Indias. We had the one at the beginning when they were still owned by the Indian folks, and then they were going into financial problems, and they got halfway through the season and it looked like they were going to disappear, and then they basically Perez forced them into receivership by suing for his salary, which sort of actually in a weird way ended up protecting the team, and then they got bought by the consortium led by Lance Stroll's father. Mm-hmm. And became another version of Force India. So they lost all their points and had to restart, which is really weird.
There's no way they're going to be called Force India next year, is it? I mean, they'll be...
No.
Because right now they're Racing Point Force India, which is like they had to keep everything together. But they're going to be Racing Point or something like that, aren't they?
Well, at the moment, they're Racing Point. So they've officially changed from Racing Point Force India to Racing Point now.
Oh, okay.
But they're talking about they might actually do a rebrand before the start of the season with yet another name. So,
well, I know they copyrighted Force One at one point, but
right, yeah.
But so but Stroll awesomeness. I don't know what.
Daddy's team. I don't know.
Yeah, it was neat to see in the practices after the last race they all changed clothes and were in their new clothes, and you saw Lance Stroll in the pink, which was funny.
And yeah, before he was officially announced as a driver, but he already had a driver. So,
And Kimi was in the Sauber. That was neat.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing with Force India is they probably do more with the least amount of money than anybody on the grid.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably the lowest funded team on the grid.
That's amazing.
And they do amazing stuff. And really, they're very cautious about when they bring in new stuff. You know, they don't put it on the car unless they know it's absolutely going to make a difference, a positive difference. They have a very systematic way of developing the car and driving it forward, if you pardon the pun. So I think they could potentially do great things if they're going to get even more funding through the new ownership. So I'm not sure about their driver lineup for next year, but I think they'll have a good design car and they'll do good stuff with it.
They were the team a year ago that looked like they weren't just the best of the rest. They looked like the team that if, you know, on their day, they could actually get on a podium. And they did a couple of times. And then the beginning of this year, they kind of faded and it really became more Renault, I guess, in that position, or even Sauber or Haas, though never to the extent that Force India was last year. You know, I mean, because there were times last year it looked like Force India could actually compete and maybe even win a race or two. And that just wasn't the case this year, even at their best.
Yeah, I mean, last year they were fourth in the championship, and as you said, they looked stronger and looked like they were going places. I think the first half of the season this year was really overshadowed by what was going on financially and all the stuff with their owner being hunted by Interpol. I mean, that's obviously going to take a little shine and distract you from day to day job. So.
Having to wear a trench coat and a Groucho Marx glasses and mustache and a fedora to work kind of takes away from it. What about the dynamic duo at the bottom, Williams and McLaren? I mean, those are two teams that I am to understand were once good, but I wouldn't know this because I've always ever seen them as like the Cleveland Browns of racing. So
once good is an understatement. This is the real tragedy.
Yeah.
I don't know. They were talking about some record that Ferrari just got, I think, in terms of front row lockouts or something, and they said and they've just equaled Williams and McLaren's record. That Williams and McLaren were the top teams. They were the Mercedes and the Red Bull not that long ago. I mean, they multiple championships. The year that Senna and Prost won 15 when the season was 16 races, and they won 15 out of the 16 in the McLaren. They were the top teams and had been for decades. Pretty much, Williams was a top team pretty much from sort of the early 80s right the way through to the mid 2000s. And McLaren had just been a top team since the early 70s through. It seems to be this modern hybrid era, but has caught them both completely flat footed. Interesting that they both have slightly different financial models than the rest of the teams. Williams is actually a publicly traded company. It's the only F1 team that's a publicly traded company, so they have shareholders and stuff that they have to sort of.
So they're the Green Bay Packers of the Formula One.
Formula One, yeah. And McLaren have all the funding from the folks in the Middle East, but then they went through the whole. Sacking Ron Dennis, the longtime chairman and team manager, and the sort of boardroom shuffles and buyouts there two or three years ago, and then the whole debacle with the Honda. They've sort of lost their way both in the boardroom and the way they operate, they sort of not really found that magic again. So I'd like to see them both coming back up. I know George Russell, the F2 champion, who's just signed for Williams, he said, he basically wants to rebuild the team around him and drive it forward. So it will be interesting to see if he manages that. I think McLaren are pretty much going to go through the same things next year as they did this year, but without the advantage of having the
great driver.
The most charismatic driver on the grid in one of their cars. Yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad. Well, we're going to talk in just a second about who's the new drivers as we'll go through here. But a couple of innovations. We had the halo this year. What did you think about the halo? Because I got to tell you, I got used to it fairly quickly. But I don't want aesthetics to hurt in terms of what they need, what safety, especially after some of the injuries in IndyCar. But what did you think? Was it effective? Did it ruin things for you?
It's interesting because I was very anti-halo when they said they announced it, and I was like, they should wait and put the aero screen on like IndyCar's going to do. It looks horrible and it, ruins the cars. And the first few races, it was like, yeah, it's horrible. So interesting, I found the ones where they just left it black and didn't paint it in the car color. It's sort of, I tuned that out quicker than the ones that were in the car color.
Yeah, that's true. It really stood out on the Ferrari.
Yeah, it did with the red and
red,
stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I sort of got used to it. I still don't like it, but I appreciate it more, particularly after I can't remember where the race was, but basically one of the cars went over the top of Leclerc and you could see the skid marks across the halo where basically the halo had kept the car off Leclerc's head. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe this thing does work. Then we had the accident at Abu Dhabi at the end there with Hülkenberg when he flipped and the car ended up upside down. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that halo's going getting in the way of him getting out. But from what I've heard and read since, it was basically, it actually kept him suspended in a way that the doctor could get to him, even though the car was inverted, and made it easier for them to sort of administer to him and check he was okay. So, you know, I think it's proved its point. I still worry about a smaller piece of debris. You know, just before you started watching F1, but we had the thing where Rubens Barrichello got hit by a spring that came off the back of a Williams one point and hit his helmet. And I do wonder about how effective the halo would be against something like that, like a piece of debris coming into the cockpit. But it was interesting watching, I don't know, as a young driver on his way up, called Billy Munger, a British driver who lost his legs in a Formula 4 crash a couple of years ago and is basically working his way back up. And he actually did an extraction test with, he'd never actually been in a car with a halo to see whether he could get in and out quickly. And he did his FAA mandatory extraction test after the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix in a Formula 3 car with a halo. And he could get in and out of it just as quickly as he could a car that didn't have one. So it was interesting to see how that was working. So I think they need to switch the camera angles on the car if they're going to keep the halo, because it takes up such an amount of screen and you sort of lose that driver eye view. So I think they need to lower the camera angle if they're going to keep the halo. And I've heard some talk about them doing that next year. Though I will say the TV guys were pretty quick at using the halo as a as a graphic display thing, like putting the rev counter on it and the braking forces and stuff like that.
That was funny. I agree. That was funny. It's like they said, well, if it's going to be on the screen anyway, we might as well make some use out of it.
We've got real estate here. Let's use it.
So, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I became a bit of a convert for the halo half part of the way through, but I still prefer the direction that IndyCar are going, hopefully with the sort of the more jet fighter cockpit aero screen type thing.
Well, let's see. We're going to wrap up in a second on Formula One by looking ahead to next year. But before we do, I wanted to go through some favorites and least favorites. This was just something that came to me while I was, you know, putting down some show notes. And it's because I have some fairly strong feelings about this. So the first question I have is favorite track. And I've got to say that after watching, I've now watched three complete seasons of Formula One, 16, 17, and 18. I've got to, and it's one that we're not going to see anymore, sadly. I've got to say my favorite track has been Baku in Azerbaijan. Now, I know that's probably heretical to you longer time, you know, fans who have your, you know, you have your Silverstone and you have your Monza and Spa and all that. I get that. I do. But they all seem kind of generic to me coming in late here, whereas Baku is insane. Baku is like a freaking, it's like a demolition derby rally. It's survival of the fittest. It's like the Hunger Games in cars. And I like that. I wouldn't want every race. I wouldn't want every race to be like Baku. But it's just, it's like, you know, survive in advance. It's the exact opposite of a race like Russia or Monaco where they do a parade. It's insanity. So what do you think? A favorite track, and then what do you think about Baku? Because I got to know your response to that.
Okay, well, I'll answer the second half of that question first. I actually love Baku. I think the first year it was used, it was a completely boring and professional processional race, a bit like Monaco, and it was like, oh, what are we doing here? Since that, and it's been crazy. Each year's been crazy, so I love that. I was just looking at the 2019 schedule. It is on the schedule for next year.
It is? Oh, good. Okay, I was hearing they were phasing it out, so that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. It's always been crazy races. I would say it was one of the best races this year was at Baku. Not the best, but it was one of the best races this year was at Baku. I love that. It's interesting. You mentioned those classic tracks, like Spa and Monza and, you know, Silverstone. I love those circuits, but they've been gutted over the years with chicanes and track shortenings, and you know, Hockenheim was another one where they just sort of gradually made them smaller and tighter. And you know, I still love Spa. I think nothing beats the seeing a Formula One car go through Eau Rouge. But it used to be that you had to be brave to take Eau Rouge flat, but now they all take Eau Rouge flat, so it's lost a bit of its sparkle. So I don't know. For me, and I'm not saying this just because it's my local track and it's just down the road from me, but I love CODA, Circuit of the Americas. And one of the reasons I do is when they were designing it, they actually went around all the other tracks and said, which are the most challenging bits of these tracks? Let's stick them together. And how can we stick all these pieces together in 3.5 miles? Mm-hmm. So you've got that, you know, you've got that crazy uphill turn, tight apex turn one.
Right.
You've got the swoops, which are from Silverstone. You've got sort of the hairpin, which is from Turkey. You've got that straight. You've got the stadium section, which is from Hockenheim. And then you've got sort of the crazy run in and that off camber turn 19, which is my favorite spot in the world, to finish the lap. I love CODAs. It can produce some boring races. I will say last year's motorcycle Grand Prix, which we went to, was one of the most boring motor races I've ever been to at CODA. But the year before, the motorcycle Grand Prix was amazing. And this year, you know, that final race with Kimi and Verstappen and Hamilton all challenging each other, really close. I think was a great race at CODA.
Absolutely.
And the year before with Verstappen's balls out move off track of Raikkonen. So mm-hmm. I think CODA, you get good racing at CODA. So yeah, it's always a good event, always a good race, and that's why it's my favorite track.
Well, speaking of CODA, what do you think about IndyCar going there? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh boy, from the day they opened COTA, I was like, I want to see IndyCars on this track.
Ah, yeah.
I never thought they would because of the agreement with the Texas Motor Speedway, which is only 3 hours away. Mm-hmm. Running the ovals there, I thought they'd never get an agreement to do two IndyCar races in Texas. They used to do a street race in Houston many years ago, but I never thought that would actually happen, competing promotions and all that sort of stuff, but they've made it happen. It's great, and tickets are bought, parking passes are bought for March, so we will be there turn 19. We will be there.
Awesome I've already reserved my tickets for, and let me just tell you, by the way, while we're talking about that, tickets for Gateway in its third season next year, the IndyCar race here in St. Louis area, woo, did they go up. They've really made some changes. It was a very inexpensive activity for us to do last year and this year, but next year, it took me some serious change to keep our same ticket seats, because we had really good, we got in on day one, basically, and had really good seats up above the start-finish line, up near the top. And those things this year, coming for next year, they jacked the prices way up. So I just went ahead. I'm like, well, if I'm going to spend this much money, I just went ahead and got us all paddock passes.
Cool.
I'm like, if we're going to be there and we're going to spend this much money, heck, let's just go ahead and shoot the whole wad. So,
yeah.
All right, least favorite track. Again, I'm going to say, there's a couple I don't like, but Sochi, the Russian Grand Prix, to me, at least Monaco has the pretty scenery as they drive around slowly, and the occasional Daniel Ricciardo win, whereas Sochi is boring, boring, boring. They don't pass on it. The scenery is dull. It's just, I don't like it at all. What do you think about Sochi, and what's your least favorite track?
I don't like Sochi at all either. It's a Mickey Mouse circuit built around an Olympic village. I don't know. It just has no character to it. It's a fairly artificial surface in the fact that it's not really a natural terrain. It's incredibly smooth. It's like a billiard table. There's no real elevation change to it. So, and as you said, it's not like you can, like, even with Baku, when it's a boring race, you were still going, how are they going to get through that chicane between those two castle walls?
Yes.
Or, you know, with Spa, it's like, oh, they're going up in, you know, they're in the forest, or Hockenheim, they're getting, or Mexico, they're coming into the baseball stadium. So, you know, there's something different to sort of hook onto. But Sochi, I can never tell where they are on the track the scenery. And a bit, actually, is the same with my least favorite track, which is actually the season-ending race. Considering at the end of the season we have CODA, Mexico, Brazil, mm-hmm. which are all three great tracks that get great racing and have got great character and history and stuff, and then we go to Abu Dhabi and it's like, it has the Ferrari theme park and big yachts and big hotels. I mean, when we were watching the race, you know, the other weekend, my wife Jill was like, she's like, where's the crowd? There's no atmosphere. There's no people at the, you know, they're just sat in the expensive seats. There's no, there's nobody on grass banks waving or, you know, they're just, it was just a dead atmosphere. So, yeah. And that's, there's always processional racing, processional racing there, unless you're Fernando Alonso and decide to cut the track.
Yes, that was one of my favorite moments. That was so great.
At every corner and ignore the actual way the track goes, because you don't care anymore.
Oh, we gotta tell listeners what happened. Gotta tell listeners what happened. They, at one point in the middle of that race, or toward the end of that race, that the announcers go, and Fernando Alonso has just set the fastest lap. And they're like, what? And they're trying to figure out, how did Fernando Alonso set the fastest lap? And they're like, oh. Then you see the video replay. He's like, oh, he just went in a straight line and cut the entire corner.
Three times.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah. He was just racking up penalty after penalty. What was he at, 15 or 20 seconds worth of penalties at the end of the race? He's like, oh, I don't know.
Did you hear his quote about the points?
Yeah, that was going to say, that was my other favorite part of that, was when his engineer said, you know, you can get that one extra point. And he's like, I've already got 1,800. What do I need an extra one for?
Yes.
Which is actually funny, because he actually got it wrong, because he actually had 1,899 points at that point. So if he'd have got that one extra one, he'd have finished his career with around 1,900 points.
Oh, wow.
So he got his math wrong. But I thought it was good. I mean, it was like a race a few races earlier when he was like, do you want to come in and make a change? And he's like, I'm racing for 14th. Why the hell should I bother?
He had a good perspective by the end of the year. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I tell you, in fact, you know.
Gonna miss him.
Well, that's what I'm going to say is, you know, we were hearing he was going to go to Indy, at least to the big race, Indy 500. And I was saying, man, you know, I sure would like to go to the Indy 500. But I didn't have any idea how much it cost. I was sure it was enormously expensive and all that. And well, I got up one morning, and just then the news had broken overnight that he was going to definitely race Indy 500. And I thought, well, A, if I'm going to go to Indy 500, I want to go a year that he's there. And who knows, this could be the only time he does it, you know. And I thought,
if he wins it, he's not going to come back.
Yeah, he's done. And B, I thought, if the word gets out through the next few days, there's going to be even harder time getting decent seats. And I thought, well, let's see how much they are. And do you know the Indy 500 seats are less than Gateway? At least the ones that were available that day were cheaper than Gateway. So I paid a lot more for my seats at Gateway than I did for my seats at Indianapolis. But I did get us seats to Indianapolis, so we're going to go over there for that race. And Mira's very excited because she likes Formula One, and she'd be glad to see Fernando too. Okay, so you want to talk about like the best races of the year?
I mean, this was just sort of my top five. I think number one, we've already mentioned it, was Baku. It was another crazy race. The two Red Bulls going toe to toe and blowing, you know, colliding into each other.
Yeah.
You know, that was coming all year. Bottas's tire blowout, you know, and then there was just people bouncing off the walls all over the place at Baku. Yes. I think it was just another awesome, crazy race to watch. You never knew what was going to happen. And then sort of my number two for me was the United States, was Kimi's win and the battle we already talked about.
It was a great race.
Even though I actually wasn't there this year, I actually had to watch it from a TV in my hotel room in New Orleans, but I was there in spirit. Germany, I thought was another great one. It was a weather-impacted race, and we had the unbelievable moment of Vettel stuffing it into the wall in front of 70,000 German fans in the stadium section at Hockenheim.
Good grief.
Complete disbelief. Brazil, Verstappen, and this, we're going to talk about this. So Verstappen on the charge through the field and taking the lead. And then we get the handbags at dawn standoff with Ocon, where Ocon's trying to unlap himself and Verstappen doesn't let him go. And Ocon hits Verstappen and Verstappen spins out of the lead and ends up in third. And then they get to the weighbridge and we get the shoving match between the two of them, which was ridiculous. So it was fun. It was ridiculous. But as I said, you know, this is where Hamilton said to Verstappen afterwards in the green room, you know, that he didn't have anything to lose and you did. You should have just let him go.
Have some perspective, son.
Yeah, but a great race. And then the British Grand Prix, I think this was Hamilton actually at his best when he got spun out by Kimi at the first corner and then raced his way up from sort of P18 to P2. There was some great, with Verstappen, Ricciardo and Hamilton, there was some great drives from the back of the field this year with...
There were.
Yeah.
That always is as fun to me as watching somebody fighting at the front. Let me put it this way. When I watch the practices and I watch the qualifying and they say, oh, and so-and-so is, Verstappen is going to have to start at the back, or Ricciardo is going to have to start at the back, or Lewis is going to have to start in place 10 or something. I'm excited. I'm like, ooh, because I know this isn't just going to be stretching out the string. Now there's going to be some people going around some people early on. And it's always interesting, too, because they'll say, oh, he could get as high as fifth or sixth. I'm like, nah, if it's Lewis and he starts at the back, he'll be in the front before the three quarters of the race. You can't limit what he's able to, what he's capable of doing. He can easily get to the front. But he can.
Yeah, over Verstappen, where he'll take, six people or whatever on the first lap. It's just,
yes.
Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Well, let's look ahead at 2019 real quick, and then we'll get on to Indy a little bit. We've talked a little bit about it already, but just to kind of wrap it all up, the grid as it stands now, let me run through it, and then you can talk about which ones you want to talk about that moved. Mercedes and Haas, of all people, are standing pat. But Ferrari pitches out Kimi Raikkonen and brings in Charles Leclerc from Sauber, and they swap places, so Kimi goes to Sauber. Red Bull keeps Max. He'll now have the little black thingy on top of his car, while Pierre Gasly is the latest Toro Rosso to be promoted up, and that's because Danny Ricci is taking his shoey to Renault, and they are losing, Carlos Sainz, right?
Yep.
Who goes down to McLaren, who's losing, it's like dominoes falling. They're losing Fernando, so they've got Carlos Sainz, and they pick up Lando Norris. You can talk a little bit about him again. He sounds like a Babylon 5 or Star Wars character. So Renault's got a really good lineup with Ricciardo and Hülkenberg, as we mentioned earlier. Then there's the team, this is all capital letters, the team formerly known as Force India, which will now have Lance Stroll as their, I guess, senior driver, since his dad owns it, and Sergio Perez. And then Toro Rosso brings back the torpedo, Danny Kvyat, along with, I've never heard of this guy, Alex Albon. You can tell us about him. At Sauber, we get Kimi Raikkonen, as I said, with Antonio Giovinazzi. And then finally, the Williams team has two new guys as well, with George Russell, I've never heard of him, and Robert Kubica. About all I know is he used to be a driver, and then he got hurt somewhere, and now he's back. So tell us what you'd like to tell us walking through that field, Alan.
All right. So we talked about Ricciardo to Renault, Gasly to Red Bull. You pretty much said it. He just got promoted up from the Toro Rosso team, which is the point of the Toro Rosso team. Leclerc to Ferrari is amazing because Ferrari very rarely, in fact, I don't think ever, have taken anybody with such little experience in F1 into the team.
I was wondering about that. Yeah,
to take somebody after just their first after their rookie year is really unusual. And is a big gamble. I know he was a Ferrari junior driver, so they know him and he'd already done some testing. But he's shown such racecraft and speed in his first year. He's been phenomenal in his first year. So it'll be interesting to see what he does, and it'll be interesting to see what that does to Vettel. To have somebody young and hungry in the team, as opposed to Kimi, who was just, I think, to a large extent, enjoying himself and cashing the checks. But Kimi, we talked about Kimi going back to Sauber. I think he's going to at least provide some foundation for that team rebuilding. Sainz to McLaren, to me, smacks of desperation to stay on the F1 grid. He keeps going on about how he's replacing his childhood hero Alonso at McLaren, and McLaren's got all this history, and it'll be great. I think it's going to be sad to see him tooling around at the back of the grid next year, to be honest.
Yeah, that's fair.
Lance Stroll to Force India, worst kept secret in F1. I think Stroll this year has been terrible in the fact that he clearly just didn't want to be in the Williams and made it very obvious with every post-race interview that he was just basically tooling around.
Yeah.
Sorokin was doing his utmost to make that car work, putting in some really stupendous drives at time with a really terrible car, and Stroll was just tooling around. I really don't like Lance Stroll, so I'd be interested to see what he does at Force India, whether he changes my mind.
It's still hard to believe he got a podium last year.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's crazy.
So the guy's leaving. Marcus Ericsson's going to IndyCar.
Yeah, I'm excited. Looking forward.
He's taking Robert Wickens' drive, but not his number. They're keeping Wickens' number open for if he ever wants to return, which is really cool. Marcus Ericsson's going to the team to replace Robert Wickens. So interesting to see how he does there.
Yeah, really exciting.
Stoffel van Dorn, who I believe never really got the chance to show what he can do, is off to Formula E, the electric car series.
Alan, am I wrong that I'm suddenly interested in Formula E? Should I just purge my brain of that or what?
No, I'm actually started. Some of the drivers that are moving over to Formula E and the Formula E support series and stuff, it's like, this is starting to look interesting.
It is.
And the cars look really radical. I mean, the cars look like something out of a video game.
They do. And they've got the Mario Kart thing going. Did you hear about this?
What, the popularity boost or the vote boost?
No, they have a thing where there's parts of the track you can drive on and it gives you boosts. But it's invisible. So you basically have an incentive to drive off the racing line to try to see if there's, like, coins hanging in the air or something.
You drive
off the racing line off the right and you'll be like ding ding ding, and all of a sudden you rev up a little bit. That is cool.
But if you get it wrong, everybody passes you.
Yes, exactly. It's stupid in a way, but it's fun, you know what I mean? It's not really racing, but it's Formula E. Why not have something wacky like that?
That's right. I love that. So we talked about Ocon going to Mercedes as the reserve driver. I think he should be in the second seat next year.
Yeah.
And then Hartley and Sorokin have no idea where they're going. And of course, Fernando Alonso is going to take over the world and win every race. I mean, we know so far he's doing the rest of the world sports car championship season. He's doing the Indy 500. He's doing the Daytona 24 hours, the Rolex 24 at Daytona. So we'll see what else he does.
I am looking forward to seeing it. Well, we did find out at Indy that he's going to have a Chevy engine. That's just something new that's just come out last couple of days. They're not going to be Andretti basically this year. They're going to be their own thing, McLaren, and they're going to have Chevy engines.
Yeah. So I hope they run a better IndyCar operation than they're running an F1 operation at the moment. So, and it's interesting that he's obviously keeping that McLaren tie. So you never know if McLaren figure out their woes and move their way back up the F1 grid. We may see Fernando back in an F1 car in a couple of years.
I'd love to see it.
The new guys you mentioned, George Russell, he's at Williams. He's the newly crowned Formula 2 champion, a Brit.
Okay.
Great, good driver.
Okay.
Lando Norris is also another Brit Formula 2 runner-up and actually led the Formula 2 championship for quite a while. Probably be cheering for him. Even though he's in a McLaren, because he's actually from my wife's hometown.
Oh, cool.
And then Alex Albon, the guy you'd never heard of in the Toro Rosso, he is actually, he came third place in the F2 championship. And I think this is the first time in about 15 years that the top three in F2 got promoted to F1 at the same time.
Nice.
He is actually London born. He's a Brit, but he actually races under a Thailand racing license. Because his father's from Thailand, apparently.
Interesting.
Those three very much carted together, came through the British single seater ranks together, and have pretty much come through from karting to F1 to get together as be interesting, because like Hamilton and Rosberg, they were good friends in karting in the lower formula, and then Hamilton and Rosberg had that major deterioration in their relationship. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with these three guys when they get to F1. Same with Verstappen and Ocon. They used to be good buddies and now don't talk to each other, and so it's interesting to see how that will go.
Kubica.
I will say about... Go on.
I was going to ask you about Robert Kubica, because I've heard about him for years, but I don't know anything about him.
Okay, so 10 years ago, he was the rising star of Formula One. He was the Max Verstappen of that age.
He was a
hotshot Polish driver, was tipped to be a world champion. He won a couple of Grand Prix with Sauber, BMW Sauber. Had a huge crash at Canada, which you can find in all the highlight reels, which he just walked away from with very minor... I think like he had a cracked wrist or something, but it was just like one of those, oh my God, nobody's going to get out of that sort of type crashes. And he moved to Renault, got on the podium at Monaco with Renault, signed a deal to go to Ferrari this following year, and then was out doing rallying. He did a lot of rallying to sort of keep his eye in, and had an accident where the Armco barrier actually pierced the car like a sword and took his right arm off.
Oh, God. He's only got one arm?
I think he was actually pronounced dead on the scene, or I might be slightly wrong, but he was certainly bleeding out a lot. Anyway, if you really want to go look, there's some pretty horrible video on YouTube. He had a really, really bad... Basically, the barrier came through the floor of the car and the door and sliced into his right arm, and I think it was only sort of hanging on by a couple of tendons and the skin.
Geez.
And they reattached his arm, and he's basically spent the last 8 years getting back to race fitness. For a long time, he wouldn't go near a racetrack, and then he sort of did a couple of races, and then he sort of realized he wanted to come back, and has sort of amazing determination to get back, not just into racing, but actually get back to racing at F1 level. Tested for Renault, tested for Williams, was test driver and reserve driver for Williams last year, and has now got the race seat for next year. The big question mark still remains is, can he do a Grand Prix distance? I think he only has hardly any strength in his right arm. I mean, you can see it in the interviews. It's still very withered and puny compared to his left arm, and he sort of still holds it a little funny. So he had to go through the safety test of whether he could get in and out, whether he could control the car. So huge determination to get back in to the grid. So it'll just be great to see him on the grid, and he comes with a whole bunch of experience and knowledge about Formula One, but interestingly, not Formula One in the turbo hybrid area or with these sort of tires. So on one hand, he's actually going to be a really experienced asset for Williams, and on the other hand, he's actually as much a rookie as the other guys. So going to be interesting to see what happens, but just a great story for him to get back into an F1 car and get a race seat.
Well, I think we all know Kvyat. What about Antonio Giovinazzi? I've heard that name forever, but I don't know anything about him.
He did a couple of races for Sauber, if not this year, maybe not last year, maybe the year before. He did two standing races for Sauber, and basically he was really good in the first one, then spun right in front of the pit lane, and then he did the second one and did exactly the same thing at the last race and was... punted off to, and he's been a Ferrari junior driver for a while. So, he has taken the Ferrari seat at Sauber. Sauber has, is a Ferrari junior team, and they have one of the seats is sort of designated the Ferrari seat. And Antonio Giovinazzi has got the Ferrari seat at Sauber for next year. And then this is his chance to sort of show that he can actually complete a race. He's fast. He's fast and he's good, but, he sort of has a little history of spinning at the wrong place on the track.
Well, that's pretty much everything that I had for Formula One. Anything else before we go ahead and do a little bit about IndyCar?
I'm really looking forward to 2019. The next 190 odd days can't come quick enough.
Absolutely.
New stuff on the slightly rule changes for the cars. Just the mix. We're going to have to be on top of our game to figure out who's in what car driving what color and next season. So it should be interesting to see whether Lewis can maintain his uh his level of performance, whether anybody can step up, what happens with Red Bull and the move to Honda and all the driver changes. So I think it's going to be an interesting season in 2019.
And the thing also I'm concerned about is that we didn't have any commercials with ESPN using Sky's broadcast this year, but I'm concerned that they're not going to do that next year. I hope they keep it up. I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic because the commercials in IndyCar drive me nuts. But it was so nice to just have an uninterrupted, you know. It's one of the reasons that I seem to enjoy European sports more than American sports, other than college football, which is my thing, is because soccer and Formula One, they don't have TV commercials. It just goes, and it's fantastic. And I've, you know, grown up my whole life watching American sports, which were basically created to have stoppages every couple of minutes so you can do a commercial. So it's just so nice to watch sports that just go, and you don't have to keep stopping for ads.
Yeah, I hope they do the same. I think it was really cool that they did that. I mean, I'm hoping they do that. I hope they get the Formula One TV app actually working this year. I might, if I start hearing good reports instead of bad ones, I might, you know, pay out for that. But the commercial free Sky Sports coverage was really good, and I touch wood they'll keep it going that way as well.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, I had no need for the pay-per-view or app thing this year because the ESPN Sky coverage was so great. If they cut into that with ads and stuff, I may very well be willing to shell out some money to keep that commercial-free total coverage. That would be what would do it for me right there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, we talked about the new car. We've won IndyCar. So for IndyCar, it was a good season. It's wide open. We talked about the new car designs. I loved them. You like the idea that they are more – I like how you put it. They have more speed than grip. Kind of, give us a quick kind of explanation of how that works and how that what that is that you like.
Because it actually puts more of the control back on the driver. I mean,
you know, okay.
I did my college thesis on race car aerodynamics. So I'm a big proponent of aerodynamics, but it's got too much. Where you know the amount of grip from the aerodynamics is more than the mechanical grip of the car or the power of the car. So really, it's just the air sucking it around, and they end up being like slot cars, or you get to the thing a bit like we suffer in Formula One, where they create so much turbulence that the car behind can't really follow. And you end up with gimmicks like DRS to drag reduction systems to get cars close to each other. I love seeing, my motorcycle passion is, you know, guys on dirt going sideways. I love to see race cars going sideways. I love to see them locked up. I love to see them being driven on the throttle, steering on the throttle where guys are actually, controlling it by the amount of power going through the rear wheels. And that's where IndyCar's gone back to, is that looser, more oversteer type thing, because now they've reduced the downforce to the extent that they're getting most of the grip through the mechanical grip of the car, and there's sort of more power coming through and less aerodynamic grip. So
you definitely that in IndyCar, in Indianapolis 500.
They're
all over the place.
And I love the fact that IndyCar have gone in that direction. I think it's a nod to the past. I know you say you can never put the technology genie back in the bottle once you've discovered something, but I think IndyCar's gone the right way in their rules and the redesign of the car to actually make the racing more entertaining and put more of the onus back on the driver's skill. And I think it's certainly leveled the playing field.
And I think it made the probably in some ways the best technical driver in the whole field win.
I think so. Though I think a lot of that came down to the double point score last round, which I don't like. So I think that's a bit of a gimmick, but and you know, there's the old engineering maxim: if it looks right, it is right. And boy, those new this year's Indy cars look beautiful. So they look fast standing still.
Well, the ones before, from 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they were just so boxy. They had too many things glued onto them. They didn't look organic.
Yeah.
They looked like there was a sleek race car in there somewhere, but it had stuff glued on top of it. whereas this car looks all natural, like one piece.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot better. My boy, let's talk about my boy. My favorite driver, Alexander Rossi, he had a year. I mean, you know, people that thought he was a one and done Indy 500 luck out, you know, fuel efficiency winner, he came out and was, for stretches of this season, the most dominant driver. And I was very happy about that.
I think he was awesome. I think he, to your point, I think he really stepped up this year and proved himself to be a potential champion. And I think he was a real revelation. I mean, you know, he was winning on every different type of race course. I mean, he was, you know, dominant right out of the gate at St. Pete's until he got punted off. And then, you know, he dominated at Long Beach. He dominated at Pocono. You know, again, amazing drives through the field when he found himself at the back. And just some of his overtaking moves, particularly on some of the ovals, were just awesome to watch. It was like, he can't be going around there. Oh, my God, he is.
yes.
You know, squeezing between people on the wall at ridiculous speeds, or, you know, going between two cars. Just amazing to watch. So I think he definitely stepped up. And again, I think if it hadn't been for bad luck on that in that last double points scoring race, he and Dixon's amazing look at Portland the week before.
Oh, that made me sick.
I think Rossi would have been the champion. So.
Yeah. Here's the thing for me. With IndyCar, there's really not any driver I don't like. With Formula One, there's some drivers I really like, and there's some drivers I don't like, you know, and that's just normal. But with IndyCar, I look at all of them, I'm like, oh, you know, I like this about that guy. Well, that guy's pretty cool in this way. I mean, you know, there's just a handful of them I don't really root for at all, and I'm not a big supporter of Penske just because they're kind of like the Dallas Cowboys or something, and I've never been big on like the front runners, you know, with all the money and everything. But I mean, I still like their drivers a lot. They're all very personable guys in their own ways. I mean, when I first started watching IndyCar again in the last few years after watching it when I was a kid, I thought, oh, they've got this French guy that's the champion, Simon Pagenaud. I'm going to hate him. And then you get to know Simon Pagenaud and you're like, oh, I like him. He's a pretty nice guy. He's pretty cool. He's got his little dog and everything. And I even told him that, you know, I remember I didn't get a chance to tell the listeners or you, I don't think. But when we went to Gateway this year and Mira was there and we'd been watching all the different videos where Pagenaud and Newgarden were having their little autographing each other's stuff prank duel, was so fun. And I told him, I said, you guys, I said, this was brilliant because, you know, this is stuff that appeals to people. It gives you character and personality and it's appealing. You're not just robots. I told him that. And I told Pagenaud was just sitting there signing. He wasn't even looking up. He was scowling, frowning, and just signing stuff like he was going to sign it and just set it out there so people could take it and he wouldn't have to look at him, interact with him. And I walked up to him, and he didn't even look up, and he was just scowling and signing stuff. And I said, Simon, my little girl here loves your dog. And he looked up and just grinned, and he came alive. And I thought, see, here he was just doing this job that's boring. He's having to sit here and sign stuff for people that probably just want to go sell it or something, you know. And that's no fun. And then I just said something to him that was absolutely true. And it just he just looked like I made his day. It was so cool. So that is just neat to remember. These are all, you know, probably good guys. And even the ones that I don't really care for that much, like a the one that kind of annoys me, Ray Hall, even he is a pretty nice guy. You know, I don't cheer against any of them. I just like Rossi the best, but you know, Scott Dixon beat him and I'm like, well, good for Scott. You know, I don't feel bad about that. He's a technically astute driver. He's able to chug along, you know. He doesn't win every race, but he doesn't get below about fifth in any race, you know. He's just racking up points and putting in his time and doing what he has to do. And I tell you right now, it was really Rossi's championship to lose, and he did. Because Rossi made a couple of mistakes in a couple of early mid-season races that cost him a bunch of points. And if he hadn't done that, he would have been the champion. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. And I think that comes with experience. I mean, Dixon really is one of the all-time great IndyCar drivers. You know, he's up there with, the other multiple champions and stuff. So, I think you know, I think he's underrated because he sort of keeps himself relatively quiet and private. But yeah, I think he does an amazing job, and he knows how to sort of play the long game. I think that's going to be you know, his thing of going forward. I think Rossi needs, again, a bit like the Max Verstappen thing, you know, I think it's going to come with maturity from Rossi, both as a person and you know, moving into the game. I mean, this is only his third season at IndyCar, and what's it, Dixon's like 20-something season in IndyCar or Champ Car combined. So, you know, I think it's, you know, a lot of that just comes with experience. And he's dumb luck. I mean, Dixon just seems to be the luckiest guy on the grid. I mean, we talked about Portland where he got involved. Excuse me a second. He got involved in that lap one crash where there was cars going everywhere and upside down and in the dirt, and the only car that drives out from the middle of the melee in the cloud of dirt and dust is Scott Dixon without a mark on him. It's like, how the hell did that happen?
Exactly, you know. That was insane.
Yeah, so that was insane. By the way, I don't know, have you seen it yet? There's the movie that Scott Dixon did, Born Racer, that came out this year. Have you seen it yet?
I know about it. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, no, I've got it on my Amazon list, but I haven't actually sat and watched it yet. So yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
I think, like I said, I don't like the double points final round gimmick. I think that's caused issues in the past, but like Montoya not winning the championship because of that. I all good luck to Scott Dixon. And far it be for me to promote somebody else's podcast on this one. But there's this podcast series called Dinner with Racers. Are you familiar with it?
I am not.
Basically, it's two guys who are in the sports car championship, but they go out and they literally do a podcast while they're having a dinner with somebody from motorsports. They drive around the country, and highly recommend the ones with the various episodes with a lot of the current IndyCar drivers, particularly like Scott Dixon and Alexander Rossi and stuff. You get to know them and their personalities a lot better. So highly recommend Dinner with Racers.
They're good.
As well, yeah.
So a couple of other things about the year. We had to talk about the Indianapolis 500 itself. Will Power won, finally. And I also want to talk about Robert Wickens, obviously, that was a real tragedy. It was the week before our race here at Gateway, so there was kind of a damper on things a little bit. Though Mira and I did get to sign his big banner about Get Well Wickens. So let's look at we have a new team, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was the Carlin Racing, who have a long tradition in European and particularly British open wheel racing, making the move to IndyCar. You know, they've pretty much done everything in Europe except F1, and had multiple champions in F3 and F2. So it's interesting to see them move to Indy. You know, there were some mistakes along the way because they were new to Indy, but it's good to see that they're going to be back next year with another couple of drivers. So, looking forward to them sort of. They've got a long pedigree. I think they will move up the grid over the coming years.
Were they the ones that added the two, like Herta and
No, they had
the Indy Lights guys. Got the two Indy Lights guys, Colton Herta, and I forget the other guy. Something, the Mexican driver.
Yeah, no, Carlin came in with two British guys, okay. Max Chilton, and who was the other one?
Oh, Patricio Ward is the guy I was trying to think of. Patricio Ward and Colton Herta are the two that are going to be a team together next year. They're the two cool Indy Lights guys. Well, what do you think about the Indianapolis 500? We've got to talk about it real quick.
To be honest, I thought it was a bit bleh this year. It didn't really excite me that much. I mean, you know, go to Penske, what was that makes them the most winning team at Indy?
Yeah.
But the actual race really didn't do that much for me this year.
Just a lot of sliding. It was the thing that was interesting about that race was just waiting to see who would come out of like turn four and go careening sideways into the wall, because it happened to Danica Patrick. It happened over and over to several different drivers.
I'd completely forgotten Danica Patrick was even back in the race. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, she was for a little while, and then she went sliding across. They were showing, and you could see for the longest time that she was having trouble keeping it under control. She was having to slow way down in those turns because she was losing the back end. And then finally, it just got away from her completely and took her in the wall. And I just hated that. I like her a lot, and I wanted her to do well. And it made me disappointed to see that that was her last, you know, her last one, and she went out. But it wasn't just her, though, is what I'm saying. there are a lot of people having that problem, that race.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast, but I actually think there's a lot of female drivers who are way more talented than Danica Patrick. But okay, we will keep. That's probably time okay for a conversation for another time. So,
okay, Wickens, good season. Looked like he should have won a couple of races, in fact, and then he had that terrible accident.
Yeah, I mean, he was a revelation from the start. I mean, he came out of DTM gym and touring cars, hadn't driven a single seater for, what was it, 6 years or something?
Yeah.
And then just straight out of the gate at St. Pete was right up there. As you said, should have won a couple of races, was certainly going to easily be the Rookie of the Year. I mean, he still ended up Rookie of the Year, but was just a front runner from day one. And then we had the horrible accident at Pocono, which actually looked for a while like it was going to be, the worst news possible. But
absolutely.
And then there was all sorts of stuff going around about, there was quite a while before we actually found out the extent of his injuries, which was quite extensive, and he was paralyzed. But I will say, I don't know if you follow him on social media or stuff, but he has been posting the most amazing videos of his treatment and recovery and all the stuff he's doing. He posts like almost daily stuff of the physical therapy he's going through and him getting in a walking machine, and his battle to get back to walking again and fitness is just inspiring to see, and his attitude and drive is incredible. And actually, he and James Hinchcliffe, was it this week, they actually recreated the wheelchair chase scene from Days of Thunder. And put a video up that when Hinchcliffe came to visit him, they got in two wheelchairs and they were actually doing the wheelchair battle scene from Days of Thunder at the hospital. So
I can totally see Hinchcliffe doing that.
Yeah. So, an amazing guy. It does raise the, I mean, to an extent, like a couple of years ago, he would never have survived that accident. So it did show the strength of the new cars, but still some questions. I mean, because his car went over, was it Ryan Hunter Racehead? I mean, that could have been.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I was going to say, is the thing that troubled me in some ways about it the most, even beyond Wickens, was that it looked like something that could happen to anybody, any turn. I mean, in other words, it didn't look like a freak accident. It looked like an accident that on that track could happen to anybody at any time.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem of Pocono. I think Pocono is a track past its time for the speed of the modern cars, and it's also a boring race there now. I mean, it used to be one of the best races on the circuit when the cars weren't quite so fast and they had multiple lines around there. But, when they restarted the race and ran it, what was it, Rossi led like 80 out of the 200 laps or something, and there was only like two on-track passes. It was just like a tedious one-groove race. So, I think they need to take a serious look at having Pocono, IndyCars at Pocono. I don't think it's the right place for them to be. Yeah. Actually, a friend of mine was at that race and used to go to Pocono on a regular basis. And he was like, that's it. I'm not going to Pocono again. He said, I've seen too much there.
Yeah. It just doesn't look safe to me.
No.
What about the windshield? The little windshield.
Yeah. The aero screen. Yeah, I mean, I know they did some testing. They did testing on the ovals. They did testing under the lights. I'm not sure actually anybody actually ran it in a full race. I'd like to – I know they're taking their time, but I'd like to, see what they're going to do with that and bring it forward. I mean, to me, aesthetically, it looks much better than the Halo. Seems to make more sense. We'll see. See how that goes, but I'd like to see it in action, and then even if it's not on every car next year, at least run it in a couple of races and see how that works out.
Looks better than the Halo, that's for sure.
Certainly does, yeah.
Just the last couple of things here that I want to mention. We talked about Fernando, and the rumors are that they'll have two drivers, and I've been hearing J.R. Hildebrandt. Do you know anything about that, or does that sound...
No, I hadn't heard about that. All I knew was the Chevy engines thing, and they'd be running their own team this year. So that's interesting. Hildebrand has got some good experience there. So,
exactly, yeah. Right. And he's a technical guy, right? I mean, he could be of good use to Fernando in terms of that. So
yeah, Yeah.
But we will see some drivers. I'm really looking forward to seeing Marcus. The thing about Marcus Ericsson is when he was at Formula One, he never, ever was in a position that they'd want to interview him, because he never really had a big accident much that they'd go talk to him. And he never finished in the top five or anything they'd want to go talk to him. He just plugged away in like 16th place every week. And so they had never any reason to ever talk to him. I barely even knew what he looked like other than the little publicity photo where they all, you know, try to look tough and manly in their photo. That's the only time I ever saw him. So I thought, oh, he's just this grim, serious guy, because it's the only time I ever saw him. And when I saw some video of him, you know, working on his Indy car, getting fitted for the seat and everything, he was kind of loose and smiling and seemed like a friendly guy. I thought, oh, he's a nice guy. I'm looking forward to seeing it. So I just like the idea that if he could never be competitive ever in Formula One, maybe he can go over to IndyCar and join a league that is much more competitive, and maybe he has a chance to do something. And that's good. I'm sure he'd rather be in Formula One, because, you know, that's what all those guys want to be in. But I like the idea of these guys having a chance to be competitive and maybe win. And that seems much more likely for him in IndyCar.
It does. And sometimes, I mean, you know, Alexander Rossi is the perfect one where, right. You know, and, you know, going back even further, you know, Alex Zanardi and Montoya, you know, that IndyCar turns out to be the place that's best suited for their talents. So, you know, we may find that, you know, Ericsson was pretty bad this year. I mean, he even finished below Stoffel Vandoorne in the championship. So, he didn't have a good season, but he seems like a personable guy, and he seems, you know, excited from the interviews I've seen, you know, excited to be in IndyCar. And it's always a good to get to, you know, that extra mix of experience in there. So, let's see if it works out for him.
Yeah. All right. Well, any last thoughts as we run out of time here and close out for our big season ending show?
Again, like I said, just going back to the beginning, I thought it was, you know, two great seasons for both series for slightly different reasons. Looking forward to 2019 for both. You know, IndyCar, looking forward to hopefully seeing Alexander Rossi maybe do another run for the championship and hopefully get it. Looking forward to Fernando at the Indy 500.
You're reading right out of my book. That's exactly how I feel about it.
Yep. So,
and I'm looking I didn't even realize, because like I said, I bought tickets. I just renewed my seats, although for much more money, at Gateway, and then later on did the whole IndyCar thing. It just didn't dawn on me until now. We'll be going to two IndyCar races next year. Now the day still has to come that we get to go to COTA, and we want to. And one of these days, you know, Mira's going to like put her foot down, and we're going to have to. So she can see Lewis, because she loves Lewis. But at least for this coming year, I'll make my first appearance at the Brickyard, and I'm very excited about that. I've watched that race my entire life. I was a big Johnny Rutherford fan. I watched him and Gordon Johncock and A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti and the Unsers and Mears and everybody dueling back in the 70s and the 80s. And so it's just going to be amazing to finally get to actually go there.
It's a great place. I get to Indy fairly regularly on work-wise, and I always make it – any excuse to get to the speedway, even if there's nothing going on, just to walk around the place and feel the magic. Going to the Indy 500 is one of those must do things. And I'm glad I got to do it the year Rossi won. And little jealous of you going when Fernando's there. But and I'm looking forward to watching the Indy cars do their spring training at COTA, not just a race at COTA, actually also going to do spring training at COTA in February. Nice. So hopefully that will be open to the public and we can and go do that as well. So.
Well, before we sign off right now, I have to thank our many supporters that keep our shows on the air for just as little as $1 a month. You can go to Patreon, Patreon, patreon.com, and join up to support our shows. And we have to thank our current supporters: Brennan O'Dwyer, Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, Joseph Fine, Christopher Brock, Phil Amthor, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dave Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, Theodore Gary, Shannon Butson, Taylor, David Hegler, Mickey B, Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Dave Powell. We're almost done, folks. Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris Wardam Way, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, I promise I'm almost done, Mark Squire, Dave Medina, Spanky, Brent Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Craig, and our one-time and anonymous donors, including Surfer Chickify and anonymous donors. Again, these are the folks that help keep us on the air and make these shows possible, and we really appreciate you. And for as little as a dollar a month, you can join their ranks and get all the various benefits as detailed at patreon.com. Just go there and search Plexico, P-L-E-X-I-C-O, or White Rocket, and it'll come right up, and you can join up. Well, Alan, I think that's going to get us for this episode. We've covered the whole season for both races and done it all in an hour and a half. Not too bad.
Pretty good, and really looking forward to hopefully doing this a little more frequently next season. Absolutely. And actually comparing notes, because between us we'll be at least three of the IndyCar races, so that's going to be fun.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to get on out of here for another episode, and we'll see you guys in our preseason preview in a couple of months, huh?
Yeah, maybe we can do something around the spring training at COTA if that comes off. So.
Very good. All right, we'll see you guys down the road. Thanks, Alan.
All right, cheers, Van.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.